What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
And a peaceful Advent to you. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN, the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. So let's say that you are a Southern Baptist, or let's say that you are a Methodist, and you're going, well, tell me more about Advent. I don't know anything about Advent. Well, we can help you with questions like that or anything else that you want to know about the Catholic faith. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email whenever you wish, 24/7. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. All right, Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski handling the phones, and Vanessa Sanchez is handling social media for us. If you're watching today on YouTube or Facebook, you too can add your question. Just put it in the chat screen, if you would, please. Vanessa will take care of that. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Are you ready for Christmas?
No.
Is anybody ready for Christmas?
Oh, yeah.
But not you?
No.
Okay, well. Thanks for clearing up that. We're going to lead off today with a question we received overnight on the EWTN listener comment line.
Hello. This is Juan from Cathedral City, California. I just had a question on the beatific vision. Wanted to see if Dr. Anders can elaborate more on that. I don't have a good understanding of what that means and here when in the next life. If you can kind of elaborate more on that, please. Thank you very much.
Bye. Yeah, sure. Thanks. I really appreciate the question. So first of all, anytime we're talking about the next life, remember St. Paul's qualification. Eye has not seen, ear has not heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man. Right? So we are babbling when we talk about the next life at best. Okay? But the Catholic doctrine is that there is something called the vision of God, or the beatific vision.
Uh-huh.
And we're not talking about, seeing God with our visible eyes. We're talking about a kind of knowledge of God that is qualitatively different from the way in which we know God today.
Okay.
So how do we know God today? Well, we know God, first of all, by inference. Well, we don't have God in front of us as a focal object. We know things about God from the things that God has made and from God's activity in the world, both natural and salvific. God's essence, we don't know. We don't know it. I mean, imagine if you drive up to your house after work one day and you see somebody's left a box in front of your driveway or in front of your back door. And you open it up and there's, a present in there or something. Well, and there's no note. There's no note. And you have to figure out, what can I figure out about the person who sent this from the fact that there's this box and this gift in it, right? I don't know the essence. It was some kind of person. Like, it wasn't a raccoon that left this. It's a human being, someone with agency and intention and seems to care about me, and I can infer those kinds of things, but I don't know the actual essence of the thing that said it.
Okay.
And we're in a similar situation with God, right? We can infer things about God from his behavior in the world, but we don't know directly, don't know his essence. The gospel tells us that we can become like God in this life. And so St. Gregory of Nyssa says, the pure in heart see God insofar as they purify their character. The image and likeness of God is more and more reflected in their own character. So they begin to get a better grasp on who God is by seeing how they're changed by being in relationship to Christ and the gospel. But again, that is kind of a knowledge. It's a knowledge by participation, but in another sense, it's a knowledge by inference. Okay, and the promise of the beatific vision is that we'll have a knowledge that's direct and not by way of inference. We will actually know the essence of God. And it'll be something that we arrive at not through discursive reasoning, So, you know, I might come to learn something about the essence, say, of bumblebees, if I'm an entomologist and I spend my time cutting them up in a laboratory or studying them in the wild. That'd still be a discursive knowledge. It'd be kind of the analytical, linguistic knowledge. It's not that kind of knowledge. It's going to be an immediate, intuitive knowledge, like the way that you know the content of your own mind. You know, I don't have to reason to, like, let's say I'm feeling rather sick.
Okay.
All right. Which I sort of am right now. I ate something that disagreed with that. I feel a little bit off, you know?
All right.
I don't have to reason to that by way of inference. You know, I don't have a discursive knowledge. I mean, I have an immediate knowledge. Oh, you know, something's a little bit off in the old intestinal tract right
now.
And while I won't know God in my intestinal tract, it'll be an immediate knowledge of God in his essence, an intuitive knowledge. And because God's essence is infinite goodness, infinite love, infinite wisdom, all of those things simultaneously and without division, mm-hmm. I'll know those things in an immediate and intuitive way that will be the satisfaction of every desire and every longing of my heart. Now, that all sounds wonderful and very abstract and very remote from our normal experience, which is why eye has not seen, ear has not heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man what God has in store for those who love him.
You know what they say these days, you don't know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know.
All right, very good. Thanks so much.
But you can know that you don't know.
That is true.
And that's the beginning of wisdom right there.
Sounds good. All right, and we thank you so much for that call that came in overnight on our listener comment line. You may want to write that down, 205-795-5773. That is a 24-hour recording. You can, and those calls come into us, and then actually, a little bit of behind the curtain here, they actually come to me. And then what I do when I get them, I go, oh, this one would be good for Women of Grace, this one would be good for Call to Communion, this would be good for Open Line, etc. So again, that phone number, 205-795-5773 for our 24/7 listener comment line. And I'm very glad that we have that. In a moment, we're going to talk with Daryl in Rochester, Minnesota. Also, we have a question from Eva, who's watching us on YouTube this afternoon. And some lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Andrews, 833-288-3986. It is Call to Communion on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Thursday afternoon here on EWTN. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. We'll get to the phones in a second here. Here's something wonderful and absolutely free from EWTN, and that would be the ebook, My Guardian Angel. You can renew your devotion to your guardian angel with prayers and quotes to help you draw nearer to your heavenly helper with this free ebook, My Guardian Angel, My Constant Companion. It's available right now at EWTN.com/guardian angels. Again, EWTN.com/guardian angels. Did I mention it's free? I think I did. Let's go to the phones now if you're ready at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Daryl to kick things off in Rochester, Minnesota, watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Daryl, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, Tom and Dr. David Andrews. Appreciate you guys taking my call. I have one main question and then maybe two subsequent questions. But basically, is it possible for an atheist to have implicit faith and then would that atheist need to make a supernatural act of faith to be saved? And then can an atheist have invincible ignorance since God reveals himself to all people through creation per Romans 1?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the short answer to the question is yes, it's possible for an atheist to have implicit faith that leads to salvation. And yes, the atheist would still need to have the supernatural habit of faith, which is for God to grant and us to cooperate with. It's not something that we can produce because it is, by its nature, supernatural. And it would include contrition for sins and amendment of life and things like that. So let's talk a little bit about how we might conceptualize this. Now, this is what I've said so far, I think, is consistent with the objective statement of the Catholic faith, that God offers sufficient grace to every person that they might be saved, and that there is a category called implicit faith. What now follows is David Andrews's private philosophical personal opinion, and you are more than entitled, in fact, you are invited to completely disagree with me, okay?
Okay.
It is, first of all, to me, completely conceivable. In fact, I mean, it's an empirically obvious fact that there are atheists who are nevertheless not reductionistic materialists, right? Their view of metaphysics or ontology is not reductive. It's layered, it's hierarchical, and would resemble, you know, something more like Platonism or Neoplatonism, right? There's a kind of ineffable starting point to reality from which the material world cascades downward in a series of emanations, that sort of thing. It's possible to have that without the concept of a personal God. It is possible, in fact, it is empirically the case that there are atheists that have a robust account of objective morality and the virtues. And I'm thinking of somebody like Philippa Foot in her book Natural Goodness, which makes the case for a thick objective morality and virtue ethics, though naturalistic. It is possible to be a materialist, which is not the same thing as an atheist. Like, you can actually be a materialist and a theist, and you can be an idealist and not a theist. Right, so just they're not the same, but just because in today's age most atheists also happen to be materialists, I want to throw out that you can be a materialist and also still believe in personal transcendence, and that that's an important part of human flourishing. You know, you can have a conception of human flourishing that's you know, not reductive to you know, power, pleasure, sex, money, whatever it might be. In which personal ethical development is an intrinsic part of the good of the flourishing of the human being, and somebody like Aristotle actually does hold that, right? That's his view. That's Plato's view. It's possible to be an atheist and believe that that you can't save yourself, that you have to be embedded in some kind of structure, tradition, society, ritual, that's nourished by mentors, by exemplars, by mediators of one kind or another. You know, that wisdom and so forth are not things that you can accomplish on your own steam. And it's possible to have all of that package and be sort of imminently open to mystery, and in a willingness I hesitate to use the word grace, but you know, to be responsive to goodness that might come in unexpected ways that you don't fully understand.
Oh, right? Okay.
I think all of that is not only possible, but I mean, I know atheist thinkers that would fit that description in each of those categories, right? And then one might, for example, consciously reject the Catholic faith or some other version of the Christian faith because one's conception of it was narrow, right? One might have been, say, raised in a fundamentalist environment with a very kind of, you know, flat one-story interpretation of religious dogma that allows for very little in the way of nuance and has a lot of counterintuitive elements to it, that sort of thing. And so, you know, you could have a kind of personal psychological disposition that says, you know, I just can't do the religious thing in that way. It comes to mind is the atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel, who doesn't hit every one of these points, but he hits a lot of them. I mean, he has a book called Mind and Cosmos that is an argument against neo-Darwinian materialism and for something like a Platonic or a Neoplatonic metaphysic. And part of his argument for that is what he takes to be the case for the objectivity of moral values. I mean, But he also goes on to say in some of his writings that he's not a religious person, and that he doesn't want the world to be like that. I mean, he's used that kind of language. Like, I don't just not believe. Like, I don't want reality to be structured the way I think religious people say it's structured, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if he's elaborated on that. My sense is that, you know, what he and others like him probably react to is the whole, you know, white-haired, bearded guy, you know, with the lightning bolts on a throne of the depiction of the divine nature in our relationship that's, you know, servile and that sort of thing. And I don't like that either, by the way. That picture of religious life is unappealing to me as well. So, I can personally conceptualize how all that could fit together. And the Catholic faith says, as I began at the outset, that God offers sufficient grace to everyone that they might be saved, and that faith is necessary for salvation, even if only implicit.
Daryl, is that helpful for you?
Yeah, just real quick. So, an atheist, we could qualify that and equivocate on that term, because there are atheists that are self-proclaimed, but they only reject a certain conception or caricature of that, not necessarily the truth. Whereas there are certain atheists that culpably and knowingly deliberately reject the truth that has been presented to them, correct?
Okay, so that's true, but I, personally, and this is just me, right? I get an analogous question when people want to know, like, if my son or grandchild or whatever has walked away from the Catholic faith, and they were raised in the Catholic faith, so they know the truth of the Catholic faith, and they walked away from it. Doesn't that put them in a really bad situation? My response to that is usually to say something like, well, you know, they sat in catechism class. They heard a lot of words. They may actually have conceptualized, you know, at an immediate level, a lot of the propositional content. That is not the same thing to me as really understanding the Catholic faith, you know.
Living it, yeah.
Well, not just living it, but even grasping what its essential points are. Like, the Catholic faith is very clear that the Catholic faith itself is a means to an end, namely our transformation after the likeness and image of Christ in charity. And the dogmas don't save us. The realities to which they point save us. Realities that we know in a shadowy, you know, through a glass darkly kind of way, primarily by participation, not by discursive intellect. And, you know, Gregory of Nazianzus, the Cappadocian father, wrote that during the 4th century, every Tom, Dick, and Harry had a lot of discursive knowledge about the Blessed Trinity, and that you couldn't go, you know, to the public baths or have your shirt pressed or, you know, buy a new tunic without somebody debating whether the Son was begotten or unbegotten, right? And it was on every street corner, you know. And he thought emphatically that was not a good thing. Like, it wasn't good that the Trinity was such a common topic of public debate and conversation, because it had misconstrued the kind of knowledge of God that saved. Namely, Thomas Kempis has the same point. He says, it doesn't do you any good if you can define or argue for the doctrine of the Trinity if you are arrogant and therefore displeasing to the Trinity, right?
Mm.
The knowledge of the Trinity that saves is not primarily the ability to discursively defend the doctrine, but to participate in God's loving Trinitarian community, which can happen in a lot of ways, and sometimes too much discursive content can actually become a barrier to the participatory knowledge of God wherein our real salvation lies. And so, to me, it may be the case that somebody has heard a lot of discursive content. Now, the First Vatican Council teaches, as a dogma of the faith, that there is no deductive argument for the Catholic faith that is ultimately compelling.
Wow.
And if you believe, I can prove to you that the Catholic faith is true in such a way that you will be left no choice but to become Catholic. If you believe that you can do that, you are in fact a heretic.
Wow.
And the best we can do is offer motives for credibility, reasons why it might be in your best interest to make the choice to believe, but that you can never get away from the fact that faith is always at some level a choice and not simply the conclusion of a deductive argument. And Newman, develops this idea at great length in the Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent, when he talks about what is it that lead people, what are the kinds of things that actually lead people to give their assent to propositions? And like the First Vatican Council, Newman says, it's generally not deductive argument. It's generally that the doctrines or the arguments that they've been presented conform to or reinforce their basic intuitions about what's good, true, and beautiful in the world. They have pre-philosophical commitments that derive from their culture, their personality, their upbringing, their family style, that condition the kinds of arguments that seem compelling to them. And so when I apply that reasoning to the case that you've mentioned, and I say, okay, there's an atheist, and he's been given the doctrines of the faith, and he's been shown arguments for the truth of the Catholic faith, it's far from evident to me that the pre-philosophical work has been done that would make those arguments compelling and attractive to him in a way that could actually convict his conscience. I mean, let me give you a really concrete example. Imagine someone who grows up in a rural parish and they only know one priest, right? Okay. They're the only priest in the neighborhood, and that's who they've grown up, that's their parish priest, right? And he's not a particularly nice guy. He barks at them when they, you know, when they're kids and they learn to serve Mass, and he tells them they're doing it all wrong, and he really has a kind word for them. And then it comes out, you know, in the news, the cops show up at the rectory, they arrest the guy, they drag him off, and then the whole parish finds out that he's been serially abusing, sexually abusing children in the parish for 20 years, right? This has happened. We all know this has happened,
right? Oh, yeah.
And you say, you know what? All this stuff about divine grace, you know, transforming people's lives in virtue, I think that's a bunch of hooey, because this is the guy who was selling that stuff to me. Right? It certainly wasn't true in his life, and he seemed to be more committed to it than anybody. Mm-hmm. Right? Those are the sort of pre-philosophical background experiences that would make, you know, all the highfalutin doctrinal arguments for the necessity of grace ring quite hollow. Right? And I'm not going to judge that kid who grew up in that parish with the same kind of moral standards that I might hold to somebody else. Right? Now, here's the beautiful thing. Ultimately, it's God is the one that makes those evaluations.
Right.
Right. I know that there are people for whom an act of Catholic faith seems like a moral impossibility. And rather than taking the stance that, well, they're just hardened atheists who are resisting the truth, and I, the wonderful Catholic, have made this wonderful decision to have faith, blah, 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 right? I prefer to take the stance that Jesus says I should take, which is take the log out of my own eye rather than the splinter out of my neighbor's.
Sure.
And always, I try personally to maintain a positive attitude towards my neighbor and say, you know, he may be a better man than I am in ways that really count and in ways that I don't know, right? And I don't know, the French have a saying, tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. To understand everything is to forgive everything. If I really know where this guy's coming from, I might give a completely different assessment on the, quote, rationality, end quote, of his faith or lack thereof, right? And that's my perspective at any rate.
Okay. Hey, Daryl, thanks so much for your call from Rochester today. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. Danders, 833-288-3986. In a moment, we'll talk with Mary in Illinois, listening on the great Catholic Spirit Radio. We're also going to get to that question from Ava, watching us on YouTube, regarding last rites and confession and all that. So we've got a couple of things on the burner here, but we would love to hear from you as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 as we continue through Advent here on Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Do stay with us. Still time for your phone call to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders at 833-288-EWTN. We can get a few more calls in today. 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. My pleasure here to shout out to another great EWTN radio partner, and that would be Catholic Community Media, serving New Orleans and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, with 4 stations. They are celebrating 16 years with us this week. Congratulations to David Dawson, a wonderful man, and his great team there at Catholic Community Media in Louisiana, from your friends here at EWTN. All right, let's go to Mary now in Illinois, listening on the great Catholic Spirit Radio. Hello, Mary. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Anders. I have a question for you, Dr. Anders, about the origin of evil, given some of the things that are happening in the news that are so horrific and have me thinking. Am I on, by the way?
Yes.
You are.
Okay, thank you. So, what are we to believe about the origin of evil? As I think about, okay, Lucifer had an experience of emotion, right? I mean, he felt all the horrible feelings of anger and jealousy and everything and took a third of the spirits with him down to the earth. So he wasn't the origin of evil, was he? What are we to believe?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So there's two ways to answer this question. One is like metaphysical, like what is evil essentially? And the other one is historical. When did evil first emerge? And I'd like to take it both ways. So the church has philosophically pretty much always answered this question the way the Greek philosophers answered it. They said that the Greek philosophers got this basically right. And the Greek philosophical position was that we should not think of evil as a separate substance. You know, like you have a pile of evil over here and a pile of good over there, and they're forces that are kind of contending with one another. You know, if you're a fan of the Star Wars franchise, and, you know, I am insofar as I liked the first 2 films, and I liked them enough that I keep watching all of the sequels, regardless of the fact that they never seem to equal, you know, the kind of epic drama that the first 2 were able to evoke. In the Star Wars universe, you know, there's the Force. And there's the good side of the Force and the bad side of the Force. And
these
powers that are imminent in the universe, and they're contending with one another. The church says that's wrong. All right, that's not the way to think of evil, as some sort of independent thing that exists over against God or over against the goodness of the material world, you know, like some sort of infection that keeps, you know, digging away at goodness. That's the wrong way to think of it. The right way to think about evil is, you know, it's easy to see through illustration. You know, imagine you meet a guy and he's got one leg. He's missing a leg. And you say, well, you know, what's wrong with your leg? Well, nothing. It works just fine. Right? The one I got was just great. Right? Well, there's nothing wrong at all? No, I'm missing something. I'm missing something that I ought otherwise to have. Missing a leg. I should have 2. I've only got 1. Right? Fancy word for that is it's a privation, being to be deprived of something.
Okay.
And so the church's view is that evil is not a positive substance floating around in the universe. It rather describes what happens when there is something lacking to, in particular, the rectitude of human acts. So when I act in any way, take some sort of action, what would be a sort of a right ordered act? Well, it'd be one that conforms to the rule of right reason, and that can discern the objective terms of human flourishing and act accordingly. So illustration I usually give on this is that I can reasonably conclude that sobriety is in my best interest, that it affords human flourishing in a way that intoxication does not. And therefore, you know, if I become intoxicated, there is a rectitude that's lacking in my act, right? It's not the alcohol, the substance, that's evil. It's what's failing in my use of reason, that there ought to be a rectitude in my actions that is not there. And that's what we call evil.
Okay.
The reason that theory is important in the Catholic philosophical tradition is it enables us to maintain the doctrine that everything that God made was good, right? Which is biblical. God made the world, and the world's good. He looked at it and said, this is good. There's no evil in there, right? So where does evil come from? Well, if evil's a substance, then you have to posit a second God that invents it and sticks it in the system. if evil is a privation, then God is not the direct creator of evil, right? And it emerges from the freedom intrinsic to the rationality of sentient beings. The fact that they have the power to morally deliberate enables them to make acts to aim at lesser goods rather than greater goods, and in an immoderate fashion, and that's what we call evil. Okay.
Okay.
So historically, as far as we know, the first rational agent to do that was the devil. The first human to do that was our first father Adam, and we've been imitating their bad behavior ever since.
Yeah, Mary, is that helpful for you?
It is. It truly is, because I think we tend to simplify that and
I think you're right.
Evil equals Satan.
Yeah. Mary, thanks so much for your phone call. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Ava's watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Ava says, during last rites, if a person is capable, is a thorough confession in order? When a priest gave an elderly neighbor last rites, all he asked was, are you sorry for your sins? But sins were not confessed.
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, yes, confession is appropriate for last rites. So last rites is not just one thing. It's all of the various rites that one would want to have at the end of one's life.
Uh-huh.
They include the anointing of the sick,
mm-hmm.
or holy unction, confession of sins, viaticum, which is one's final reception of Holy Communion, and then the apostolic pardon, which is a plenary indulgence that the Pope gives priests the power to grant to those that are in danger of death, right? So you'd want to have all four of those to have the last rites. And if you're not given the opportunity to have the full sacrament of confession, then you would be deprived of something that would be advantageous to you. Now, there are plenty of situations where people are not capable of making a thorough confession of sins at the end of their life. Many people are not capable. And so the church presumes that they have the proper disposition, right? So I know of a case where a woman who had had a stroke and was unable to speak, but was otherwise conscious, received a priest for last rites. Priest went in and said, I know you can't talk. Tell God in your heart you're sorry for your sins, and I absolve you for your sins in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. That's the best they could do under the circumstances, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she's not. You can't ever be obligated to do something that is physically impossible to you. It was physically impossible for this woman to verbally articulate her sins. Wasn't required to.
There you go. Hey, Ava, thank you so much for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to David now. David is in Toledo listening on the great Annunciation Radio. Hey, David, what's on your mind today, sir?
Well, when the apostles were martyred, who appointed their successors and how, since they were not all together,
from
my understanding?
Yeah, thanks. So the book of Acts, chapter 15, tells us that the apostles themselves appointed the pastors of the parishes, the churches that they had founded. And subsequent literature outside the New Testament, like the first epistle of Clement, tell us that the original apostles also appointed bishops. St. Paul's pastoral epistles mentioned that he appointed Timothy and Titus as bishops of their respective sees. So the apostles themselves were responsible for ordaining bishops and priests that would carry on the apostolic ministry after them, prior to their martyrdom.
Okay.
Now, you know, as the church developed down through the centuries, for valid ordination of a priest, you have to have a bishop who does it. But in terms of deciding who gets to be a bishop, that has been answered in various ways, right? So the current system in the Catholic Church, of course, is that there is a dicastery for bishops. There's a Vatican office for bishops, and there are all kinds of people who work on this question. They make suggestions to the Pope for who ought to be a bishop and what see and where he ought to go. And the Pope either confirms those suggestions or he doesn't, and it's the Pope's discretion. That's a development. It hasn't always been that way. In antiquity, it was often the case that bishops and priests were ordained by popular acclaim.
Wow.
So one of the most famous cases of that was Ambrose of Milan, who wasn't even fully initiated into the Catholic faith, but he was a civil authority in Milan, a person of great renown and had the respect of the people. And Bishop died, and the folks said, next bishop's got to be Ambrose. And so they got him thoroughly initiated into the faith and ordained and made him a bishop. St. Augustine, when he was a younger man, deliberately avoided traveling through certain cities because he knew that if he went through those cities, someone would grab him and make him a priest by force. And he didn't want to be stuck in that particular see or diocese.
Wow. Right?
And so that happened for a while. Now, you can, when you get to the Middle Ages in the West and the manorial system that was part of feudalism, it became common for feudal lords to appoint the clergy that would serve in the lands that they had suzerainty over, right? And so they basically became, you know, they were part of the equipment of the civil order. And that system developed and grew in power, and it came to a head when Henry IV, the Holy Roman Emperor, decided that he had that jurisdiction over the Holy See. And there were, in fact, popes that had been put in power and deposed and taken out and assassinated, you know, under the influence of civil rulers. And because that pattern existed, Henry IV just thought, well, I've got that power. It falls to the emperor to appoint the pope. Well, Pope disagreed. And they had a big brouhaha over it. It was called the investiture controversy, and Pope won, and the outgrowth of that was the beginnings of the modern system of canon law, and laying out in a formal way who has what power to do what in the church and all that. But the necessity of developing that canon. Those canons emerged from the fact that there was a lot of flux in who actually gets to pick whose bishop where. Now, you know, this is all prudential judgment. There's nothing inauthentic about making a bishop or a priest by popular acclaim. And if the Pope decided, you know, we're going to go back to that system, don't think he's going to do that. But he could, and it wouldn't be any kind of threat to the orthodoxy or integrity of the Catholic faith. What matters for a valid ordination is that a valid bishop do it.
Right. David, thanks so much for checking in from Toledo. Love to get phone calls from all of our great affiliates and all of you listening in any way to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We'll get back to the phones in just a second. Tonight on The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, you may be familiar with the famous Chinese entrepreneur and Catholic activist Jimmy Lai. Well, we're going to have his daughter, Claire Lai, tonight on. Also, Jonathan Price and Father Robert Sirico. They'll be joining us with analysis of and reaction to the Jimmy Lai guilty verdict, which was handed down just this week in Hong Kong. Also, highlights from the World Over Christmases past. Always a lot of fun with that. Do check it out tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and television. You can get news from the World Over into your email inbox every week. Visit EWTN.com, click on the word subscribe. All right, back to it now. Here is Jonathan, a first-time caller from Pittsburgh, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Hey there, Jonathan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thank you so much, guys. And again, as you said, first-time caller, so I'm excited. I'm calling because I'm a seventh-grade faith formation teacher at my parish, and I think the background's a little important to the question is that I am a convert. I converted from being a Lutheran. I converted in college. And, you know, prior to my conversion, I was more proud to be not Catholic than really being Lutheran. And then after my conversion, I was so, and I still am hardcore for my faith, but I was very uncharitable to Protestants and Protestant churches. And that's very much changed over the years and to the point of, you know, especially teaching these students and how to approach, you know, their friends or loved ones that are not in the faith and doing it with charity and love. But the question that I'm kind of bringing to you guys that I've wrestled with and how to respond is when we talk about the Catholic Church being the one true church, my students will ask, well, how is that in relation to the countless Protestant denominations that exist? And the answer that I've kind of come to is God allows for things to happen because he can pull good out of anything. And it very may well be that for the countless Protestants, that's the only way they would have come to know God is through whichever denomination they were in. But, you know, I don't I don't exactly know, and I'm just kind of looking maybe for some guidance on how to approach that.
Yeah, sure.
That topic with these seventh graders, and again, my background being what it is, it's almost embarrassing to say it took me that long to get to that point. But
No, I really appreciate the question. So I really like the way the Second Vatican Council answers this question when it talks about the uniqueness and the priority of the Catholic faith. It talks about the fullness of the faith being in the Catholic Church, but that elements of truth and sanctification exist outside the Church's formal boundaries, and that those elements can be a means of sanctification and redemption. And so to talk about our separated brethren, the Protestants, let's take some concrete examples of that. What are elements of truth and sanctification that exist in Protestantism? Well, the canon of the Bible, or at least, 66 out of 73 books of the Bible. They got that. They got a big chunk of the Bible. The dogmas, generally speaking, the dogmas of the ecumenical councils, at least the first four, exist within Protestantism. Other elements of truth and sanctification would be Trinitarian baptism, the sacrament of matrimony. These are all things that properly belong to the Catholic Church, but they exist. They exist within the majority of Protestant churches. And the church says that our church, the Catholic Church, says that through those means, Protestants can come to salvation. So, yay, good for them, okay? Now, again, this is a Catholic perspective. Those elements of truth and sanctification exist alongside some objective deficiencies that I personally think can constitute a real barrier to truth and sanctification, so that people who are saved in those situations are saved not because of the erroneous things that they hold, but in spite of them. And I'll give you an example from my own life, okay? I grew up in a Calvinist community. You grew up Lutheran, I grew up Calvinist. And as you know, for Calvinists, predestination is a big, big deal. And in particular, the idea that I can know that I'm one of the elect, that's a big part of Calvinism, and that you're not, right? And so that I stand in a kind of patronizing relationship to you, And that you need to hear from me. I don't need to hear from you. I have something to share. You need to hear it. And your salvation depends on it. And I can kind of smugly assure you that I'm going to heaven, but it doesn't look too good about you. Right?
Ouch.
And that attitude towards my neighbor could be a genuine barrier to charity. Because, at least in my case, as a Calvinist, it could lead me to the urge to treat other people as a kind of target, a kind of mark, an object of conversion, and not to attend to their deep humanity or to think that they might have something to teach me spiritually that could benefit me in my relationship to God. And I did that, right? So that frustrated my own attempts at charity. Now, am I saying every Calvinist does that? No. I know plenty of Calvinists that are very, very charitable people. I wasn't, and my religion has something to do with it. So becoming Catholic for me helped me to become a more charitable human being. I got a long way to go. And there I'm still beaten black and blue by a lot of Presbyterians who are kinder and sweeter and more gentle and humble and loving than I am. But for me subjectively, becoming Catholic moved me deeper onto the path of charity and the virtues than I would have been had I stayed stuck in the mindset that I had before. All right? So that's a concrete example of how I had elements of truth and sanctification in my Presbyterian tradition.
Uh-huh.
But some of the doctrinal errors there actually frustrated my ability to benefit from those things. Now, I often say my Baptist granddaddy, he got more grace out of his two sacraments than I get out of my seven. Mm-hmm. So, bully for him. That's great for him. All right. So that's one way I would conceptualize that. as to the question, why would God permit all this diversity? St. Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 11. And he says that God permits sometimes divisions so that the truth can be manifest that much more clearly. And there's one way to take that, Protestant error shines forth Catholic truth. Mm-hmm. And you could take that. That'd be kind of a triumphalistic and maybe a little bigoted way of putting it. And there's probably some truth in that. But you could say, okay, maybe the Protestants were onto some things that Catholics needed to hear. And I'll give you a concrete example, and one that I think had an impact on influencing the future course of Catholic development. My own interpretation of the Reformation as a Reformation scholar is that one of the most neuralgic issues of the 16th century was the way laity related to the liturgy. Because the liturgy before the Council of Trent
was such that laity were often largely excluded from the mysteries. And in fact, there's a lot of really good documentary evidence that lay people would come into Mass and participate in a rite that meant to them something very, very, very different than what it meant to the priest. That really? there were divergent theologies of liturgical participation, and some that maybe frustrated the laity's ability to deeply engage in a participatory way in the meaning of the sacrifice. One of the things that Protestantism sought very vigorously to do was to bring lay people into a more informed participation in the liturgy, which is why they insisted, for example, on the use of the vernacular in the liturgy. Now, you can debate the pros and cons of that, but I think the motive, right, was not wrong, right, to want to bring people more into participation with the liturgy in their relationship to Christ. And one of the fruits of that was it prompted the reforms of the Council of Trent and also the reforms of the Mass, in particular the Tridentine Mass that's so popular with traditionalists today. That's a fruit of the Protestant Reformation in part, right? And then in the 20th century, the liturgical movement that gave us the reforms of the Second Vatican Council and Sacrosanctum Concilium and the reform of the Tridentine Mass, right? So those are, I think, positive responses on the part of the Protestant, of the Catholic Church, to challenges placed to them by Protestants, who I don't my personal view is I don't think the Protestants got the answers right, but they got a lot of the questions right. And they prompted the church to take a deeper look at some of those questions.
There you go. Jonathan, thanks so much for your call from Pittsburgh. Let's go now to Suzanne in British Columbia, listening online, EWTN.com. Hey there, Suzanne. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I was just wanting to ask what you think of the analogy between, like, love exists, but hatred it doesn't exist. It's just simply the lack of love or the rejection of love out of fear, similar to how light exists, but darkness does not exist. It's just simply the lack of, it's the absence of light, and also cold doesn't exist. It's simply the absence of heat. So only light exists and can be studied. Darkness doesn't exist. It's simply the absence of light. Heat likewise exists, but likewise cold is the absence of heat. And in refrigeration, you do not add cold, you simply take away heat. So when we are loving, we defeat all evil by remaining with God, who keeps us safe eternally, no matter what, in this world. And we'll always be fine if we remain loving, because God is love.
Okay, this is great. I love what you're saying. I agree with your formulation. I would make only one qualification. Instead of contrasting love and hate, I would contrast goodness and evil, and I would say goodness is a positive thing, evil is the absence of good. The reason I wouldn't contrast love and hate is that there are occasions when hate is a morally appropriate response. Let me give you an instance. If my child gets cancer, I think it is morally appropriate for me to hate the cancer, right? St. Thomas talks about the irascible appetite, right? This is the faculty of human will whereby we seek to put distance between ourselves and something that's evil, or we try to positively destroy the evil, right? If somebody bursts into my house, you know, with a machine gun and threatens to kill my family and, you know, harm my children or something, I don't necessarily hate him, but I hate the threat that he poses to my family. And it would be a reasonable response for me to take steps to eliminate that threat, right? So I'd be trying to prevent an evil by hating the evil, right? So that's why I like your formulation. I think you're absolutely correct. But I would make the contrast again. Goodness is a positive thing. Evil is the absence of that goodness. Hatred could be good or bad depending on the object. If I'm hating a good thing, then that's very evil. If I'm hating evil, then that's very good.
Okay. Hey, Suzanne, thanks so much for checking in from British Columbia. That's going to be it for phone calls. Can't take any more, even though they're still coming in. However, stick around for Open Line with Father Gerald Murray. That is coming up next on most of these EWTN stations at 3 p.m. Eastern. A wonderful Father Gerald Murray answering your questions on EWTN's Open Line. 3 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Dr. David Anders, thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Tom.
Always appreciate everything you do for the
you
network.
Too.
We appreciate all of our listeners, and I think you will appreciate the 48 hours of Christmas. It's coming up Christmas Eve day, all day, 24 hours, followed by Christmas Day, all day, 24 hours of music, live masses from all over the world, special programs that we've put together, programs that our partners have put together. It all adds up. We call it the 48 Hours of Christmas. It kicks off at midnight Eastern on EWTN Radio. If you'd like to check out the exact schedule, go to EWTN.com/48hours. That's all you have to do. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Friday edition of Call to Communion. We are live tomorrow. Hope that you will be with us then. Until then, have a great day and God bless.